Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Hi, I'm Lauren Sherman, the host of Fashion People. I love fashion, obviously, but shopping for fashion online is kind of annoying. There's endless scrolling, my size is always out of stock, and I can't actually find what I want. No one has really made this work for me. That is until List. Instead of browsing different stores one by one, on List you can see and shop all of the best fashion. List is the secret shopping weapon now used by all my most stylish, cool, and in-the-know friends. Don't shop around. Join 200 million fashion shoppers, including me, on List.com. That's L-Y-S-T. Or download the List app on the App Store today.
Welcome to Nothing Impossible on St. Louis's News Radio, KMOX.
Welcome into Nothing Impossible, our weekly conversation about local innovation and just new approaches, whether it's technology, I think that comes to people's minds first, but socially, civically, all sorts of different angles, innovation comes into play. Michael Calhoun and
Travis Sheridan, and it's been a while since we've been able to talk about innovation, yet people have been innovating in the midst of pandemic, finding new ways to work from home. Finding new ways to, maybe they were laid off and finding new ways to be an entrepreneur all of a sudden. People are, working through this.
Yeah, we're working through it. We're using Zoom. We've used Skype in the past to bring our guests and our two co-hosts together on this show. And today we're going to connect first off with Geosaurus, T-Rex, two dinosaur references there, but this is no dinosaur that we're talking about. It's the geospatial industry, mapping technology. St. Louis is a center for it, and we're going to talk with the head of the Geospatial Innovation Center at T-Rex.
You know what I think is great about this? We've gotten a lot of buzz and national attention for the work that's gone on at the Danforth Plant Science Center and everything that's happened in ag tech and biotech. And now the next cluster that's really developing is geospatial.
Yeah, ag tech, biotech, fintech. That doesn't have to do with sharks. It has to do with financial technology and sports technology. We've had Stadia Ventures on before and geospatial, which I think people can relate to. Everybody's used their GPS to get somewhere.
Pretty regularly, even if they're, maybe not to get somewhere, but probably to track their packages that they've ordered while doing a lot of e-commerce shopping from home.
As long as it's dropped at the door, socially distant, right?
Yep. Okay, we'll also talk about some changes that have happened in the St. Louis region as it relates to how the food and beverage industry is staying active and viable during this pandemic. We'll talk to the folks from Mission Taco about their ability to have cocktails to go. This is another policy issue that maybe doesn't get a lot of support at Jeff City, but has direct impact on the viability of businesses in the region.
Yeah, we've seen the unemployment rate in Missouri and across the country, and so many beloved businesses have had to close, and those who have not have managed to figure out how to adapt to both the new health regulations and approaches and also to what customers want these days. And customers, if they love your product, you want to make sure it's available. It's been a little bit of a struggle for restaurants in the beginning of the coronavirus epidemic because of some state regulations that prohibited the sale of some of those products. But there's been an exception. You can get your margaritas, but for how long? Stay tuned. We'll find out. And then we're going to get into a very important conversation in the St. Louis area and across the country. Carol Daniels is going to talk with the Reverend Dr. Starsky Wilson about a new announcement. You know, it just said that innovation is not just new technology, new apps, launching satellites to measure geospatial data. Socially, civically, we need new ways of thinking about things and approaching things. And so Carol's going to talk with Reverend Wilson about the establishment of this new fund in the St. Louis area. Carol's here. Tell us a little bit about what you're going to talk about.
Michael, organizers of the fund plan to focus on healing and grief and strengthen the efforts of community organizers, activists, and residents who are working to help communities of color heal from the conditions created by systemic racism. It's innovation and racial justice and social change.
The St. Louis Regional Racial Healing Fund.
We have these systemic problems, and if we think about it from a business, when we look at businesses that have broken systems innovate to improve those systems, we have to view society through a similar lens. Our system is broken, and we have to come up with new solutions for very old and systemic problems. So that's a pretty robust show we have today.
A lot going on. There is so much going on, and we'll try to bring you a little bit of an angle on each of it on today's show.
So stick around for more Nothing Impossible right after this.
Welcome back to Nothing Impossible on St. Louis's News Radio, KMOX.
Michael Calhoun and Travis Sheridan with you, talking about local innovation, new frontiers, and certainly one of those is geospatial. It's been a specialty for St. Louis, one of our industry clusters for a while, Travis, and T-Rex is really amping up their involvement in that industry.
Well, and what a great evolution, no pun intended for T-Rex, but what a great evolution of the focus within T-Rex. I remember moving to St. Louis back in 2012. The original T-Rex opened in the Railway Exchange Building, probably around 2013 or so. And, you know, the move to Washington Avenue and then the growth and focus on geospatial, I think just makes a lot of sense for not just that facility, but what that space really represents and what we're looking at as a future of St. Louis.
And let's welcome into the conversation Mark Tatkenhorst. He's the program manager for the Geospatial Innovation Center at T-Rex Downtown. Thanks for joining us, Mark.
Hey, thanks for having me. It's always a pleasure to talk about what's going on in T-Rex and what's going on in geospatial in the region. So thanks for having me.
So Mark, give us just first a brief update of what this center represents and where is it in its life cycle?
Okay, yeah, thanks. We did a soft opening in January of, it's a 16,000 square foot technology incubator and innovation center focused entirely on geospatial and related technologies. The whole focus of it really is to create an environment where geospatial startups can mature with world-class mentors and geospatial professionals to really drive their business and of course graduate them into the community, which is T-Rex's ultimate mission as well, to give back to the economic vitality of the region. So we're at 100% occupancy. And like I said, we had our soft opening in January, right before the pandemic kind of shut us down. We transferred all of our programming to a virtual environment. So we're moving right along, even in this virtual environment. We're looking at the summertime to maybe do a virtual opening, and then in the fall, if everything permits, we'll go ahead and open the doors for a live grand opening. So,
and Mark, how do you describe for people? You know, you can simplify it down and say, well, every time your phone asks for your location, think about what it uses. You know, those situations when it asks for that. But how do you describe to a layman what geospatial is and why it's so important? Why it's such a good industry for St. Louis?
Yeah, so that's a great question, and that's a question geospatial professionals get quite a bit. And I'll be frank with you, it's not an easy question to answer. But I kind of break it down like this. So any type of geospatial data has some kind of locational attribute to it. So whether that's a zip code, whether that's a coordinate, whether that's a bounding area. And then along with that geographic entity, it also has an attribute. So at a specific location, there may be an earthquake that happens, some other natural disaster. There may be, childhood, poverty rates can be described with geospatial data. The importance of it is it tells you where you are. It can tell you where you're going, and it can tell you how you're getting there or what is happening at any specific time on the Earth's surface. So obviously, people in this region know about the National Geospatial Intelligence Agency, but it kind of frames their mind that geospatial information or geospatial technologies is something that the military or the intelligence community is focused on only. And that couldn't be farther from the truth. So, you know, when you first talk about geospatial information or technologies, they think of military intelligence, safety of navigation, support to natural disasters. But the really emerging areas are the sectors that understand how it can make a difference in their business model. So, for instance, the financial market, the health sector, insurance, precision agriculture, all of those sectors are gaining advantages by incorporating geospatial information and data into their business.
And what kind of startups, Mark, are you seeing attracted to this sector?
So we're getting all different levels of startups that are coming in, anything from companies that are focusing on indoor navigation to artificial intelligence, machine learning, that want to integrate geospatial information into their models, as well as drone companies that are building capabilities and new sensors to make a difference and advance geospatial technologies and tradecraft.
And for instance, I was at one of the talks at SLU with Ness Sandoval about the different ways that, you know, especially the conversation we're having now, how geospatial data can be used to evaluate health outcomes or racial mm-hmm. disparities. What are some of the social aspects of this that can be used to improve people's lives?
Well, certainly, you know, through the pandemic, you'll see a lot of geospatial companies stepping forward to contribute, not only to locate where pandemic is hitting, the zip codes, the specific locations of the hospitals, being able to track PPE distribution. So you'll see a number of dashboards that can locate the incidence of the pandemic. But what is more important as we try to track this through time is trying to do predictive analysis on where areas may be the next hotspots. And so kind of, you know, preparing the battle space, so to speak, on, you know, where this is going to go next. How can we reevaluate and move resources to better combat and tamp down the pandemic? And also, you know, all socioeconomic data has some kind of attribute that, you know, like I said before, gives a geographic coordinate, gives a zip code, gives a region. And so all of that data can be overlain on a number of different aspects to kind of give you a picture, you know, whether it's poverty rates, whether it's distribution of health availability. To be able to kind of lay out a more distinct picture of what's going on in a community.
Well, it's interesting you mentioned some of the issues around the pandemic. I was talking to some folks I know in Sydney, Australia, and they said that one of the ways they've been identifying hotspots early is to test wastewater streams, because just like you can pick up narcotics and opioids and whatnot in wastewater, they could also pick up the antibodies of COVID in wastewater, and that allows them to deploy resources to prevent hotspots from spreading. Now, Mark, this data is, I mean, it's available because of satellite technology, but how much of it is really open source for the general consumer or even a startup to get access to?
Well, of course, there's a number of commercial imagery companies that make their data available, and it's available in a number of different formats. But there's, for instance, the Regional Data Alliance here associated with University of Missouri St. Louis. They do a lot of harvesting of open source data and making that available for a number of different uses. Within the GeoSaurus, one of the activities that we're leading toward is creating this unique environment for our startup community. We're calling it a data lake. And so what we're working with various cloud-based vendors is to kind of lay out different data, different formats, whether it's commercial imagery, it's vector data like OpenStreetMaps or full motion video. We want to create this data lake so that it gives our startup community the availability to test their algorithms, to mature their company, and to grow for the greater economic vitality of the region. But there is an awful lot of open source data that's out there and a growing number of open source software packages that can contribute to the advancement of geospatial technologies.
I have an app on my phone specifically to track my locations, and it was nice at the end of the year to plot my journey for an entire year on a map to see how many places I visited. It also helped me understand, you know, how much my commute to work was, how far my commute to work was, what neighborhoods or zip codes do I spend most of my time and most of my money. So there are personal applications of this.
Yeah, absolutely. And the amazing thing, at least from a geospatial professional and the community, and we talk about it quite a bit, is how much people don't realize in their day-to-day lives the geospatial data that they're ingesting and using just to move through the day. It's amazing, but they never really tie that to the geospatial community and geospatial data as a whole. But I'm not sure that we would be able to move through this world today without it.
And you mentioned the University of Missouri St. Louis. We've heard so much about SLU. They've got the official relationship they've set up with the National Geospatial Intelligence Agency. But between all of these companies locating here, these startups gravitating here, two academic institutions that are involved, and then the Geospatial Innovation Center at T-Rex has received donations from large companies like Bayer, all the way down to one that you just announced from Siler Instrument. Is it common for so many different pieces, from academic to nonprofit to companies to government agencies, spy agencies, everybody working together, everybody on the same page, helping to boost a city and an ecosystem? Or is that something unique you think we have in St. Louis?
Well, I will tell you from my personal experience being in this region for 34 years, I've never seen anything like it. And to me, it really boils down to leadership. From the beginning of this effort, and as soon, I mean, let's not forget NGA coming out and announcing their new or their headquarters that's going to be in North City was certainly the catalyst to all this. But it was really the leadership and the vision of some really key members of this community, Mayor Crewson, Otis Williams, Jason Hall, Julie Finn, and of course Patty Hagen, to seize this momentum and help create this environment where we're in today. And so it certainly is unique from the perspective that from government to academia to the startup community and civic organizations, everyone is really driving in the same direction and is very committed to this effort. And it's something that we see every day, where companies, whether it's a military organization at the Pentagon to a company that is established but in a different location, we get calls every single day about what is this that's going on in St. Louis. We'd love to be a part of it. How can we contribute? And I think there's a real sense of from certain sectors that they feel like they're going to get left out, because they see this train and this momentum moving forward, and they don't want to be left out. And you know, I go back to the leadership piece of this. I mean, what they've done and what that core group did at the beginning to help get us where we're at, it enables us to get the GEOINT symposium, which is our Super Bowl for this industry, here in 2023 and 2025. And that is absolutely unprecedented that that we're able to get that. It's overwhelming to be in this industry for so long and to see what's happening in this community. So,
well, Mark, you mentioned earlier that in the fall it looks like you might be able to have an actual physical grand opening. Of course, the pandemic has changed how people are working. People are working remotely. Can you talk to us a little bit about what GEOSAURUS will look like post COVID and the need for spaces like this?
Yeah, so I think what we'll see is, I think we'll slowly get back. I mean, one of our big benefits, obviously, at T-Rex and the GEOSAURUS is bringing together and connecting geospatial community members, whether it's high school students to seasoned veterans in this industry, and having those large collaborative spaces for us to build our professional and personal networks has really helped us advance what we're trying to do. I think we're slowly going to get back there. I will say that when we went virtual, we had, to me, it was an unexpected surprise because we were able to kind of expand our audience and our viewership from, you know, just the local community to now we have, you know, people in the East Coast. Last week or earlier this week, we had a speaker from Spark Geo up in British Columbia. So we're actually in a virtual environment. It gives us an opportunity to expand our message a little bit, and it gives us an opportunity to try to attract those companies to this region, whether it's T-Rex or elsewhere. So I think, I mean, as part of this whole pandemic, I think that was one of the upsides of this. And then I think that, you know, we're going to continue on this pace. And I would, you know, I'm going to be completely frank. I would absolutely love to get back to the days where we are bringing 100 people together and, you know, having these great discussions and synergy. But to your other point about looking forward to whether spaces like T-Rex, you know, their viability over time. So one of the things that we've been in discussion with a number of our partners, strategic partners, is that moving forward, a lot of large companies will not be looking for large commercial spaces. They've been given word that they'll be focused more on these collaborative ad hoc spaces where they can come in and use for alternative work sites. They can set up, you know, meeting spaces for smaller groups and then continue to work virtually where they can. So, I mean, that's another interesting dynamic that we'll have to see moving forward.
Mark, what are the halls like at T-Rex these days? I know at KMOX, they're pretty empty. Everybody's still working. They're just doing it independently. But are a lot of the startups, both on the geospatial floor and in general, is it feeling empty there, or are a lot of folks still showing up?
I started back on the 18th of May, and just to open up and allow construction to be completed and just to give people a sense of being feeling human again. And so we started seeing a trickle of people back in the offices. And of course, you know, it's we're a pet friendly environment, and we have just a buzz of activity every day. And so seeing it kind of as a trickle has been different. But, you know, every week that goes by, we're seeing more and more people feel more comfortable. And of course, we put a ton of measures in place so that people feel like that's a safe environment to operate in. We've, you know, put sanitization stations everywhere. We have put plexiglass over a reception desk and guard desk. And so we really want to ensure people that we've created this environment where they can come back. And so we're seeing that. I mean, every week that goes by, we're getting more and more. We're certainly not back to where we were when we closed the doors on March the 16th. But we talked with our tenants all the time, and they're anxious to get back as much as we are anxious to have them back.
Well, Mark Tackenhorst, the program manager for the Geospatial Innovation Center at T-Rex on Washington Avenue, thank you so much for your time. We really appreciate it.
Anytime, glad to, anytime I get the opportunity to talk T-Rex and Geosaurus and the geospatial industry as a whole, I'm excited to do so. So thanks for having me on.
And good job keeping that dinosaur thing going.
Absolutely.
Welcome back to Nothing Impossible on St. Louis's News Radio, KMOX.
Welcome back. Well, there's been a lot of change for restaurants in the wake of COVID, and one is trying to get around government regulation that they've had to deal with. Adam Tilford owns Mission Taco Joint. So just in general, how's it been for you to adapt?
I tell you what, we have, many in the restaurant group, we've opened, I think, the 7th Mission Tacos now with Kirkwood in the last 7 years or so, and I don't think we've worked harder than we have the past, you know, 2.5-3 months with all of this. It's just, it's curveballs every day, you know, just trying to switch up operations, make sure, you know, staff's feeling good. Everyone's, you know, doing things as safe as we can, you know, adjusting to a much lower volume of business, trying to make the financials make sense, dealing with PPP loans, stuff like that. So that's been interesting. It's been an interesting ride.
And the state government just announced that it would extend the exemption, allowing places to sell cocktails to go, mixed drinks to go, until December 31st. How important are these to you?
It was tough. I mean, you know, we saw such a big decline in sales once we kind of got shut down on the margarita sales that, you know, we started having talks with our staff about, you know, did we want to stay open? Were they willing to take pay cuts, things like that? And then once it came back, you know, our sales jumped back up 30-40%, and you know, it wasn't a problem. So it was a huge deal for us. It also we had, prior to the shutdown, we had 6 stores that were open. When we went to carry out and delivery only, we only did that with 4 stores. And then once the margarita sales came back, it allowed us to open up our other 2 stores again and get more people employed.
And so now it's extended through the end of the year. How do you feel about that?
Yep. It's awesome. It's great. You know, initially it was to May 15th. Then, you know, we're coming up to May 15th, and it's like, all right, what's going to happen? And we're pushing. And it's June 15th. And it was like, all right, great. And we're going to have to fight for this again as we get closer to that date. And just the fact that they just put it out till the end of the year is just, you know, it's going to give us a lot of comfort moving forward, trying to transition back to getting some, you know, dine-in service and stuff like that, that will, you know, still be able to have those to-go cocktail sales to help keep us afloat, which is awesome.
Adam Tilford from Mission Taco Joint. Up next, it's Carol Daniel with the Reverend Dr. Starsky Wilson on Nothing Impossible on KMOX.
Welcome back to Nothing Impossible on St. Louis's News Radio, KMOX.
Welcome back to Nothing Impossible. I'm Carol Daniel. The racial justice movement includes a focus on grief and trauma, wellness and resilience. Friday, 3 organizations came together to announce the St. Louis Regional Racial Health Fund, intended to transform the St. Louis region through an innovative and yet long-standing combination of community organizing and healing arts. The fund is a collaboration between the Deaconess Foundation, Forward Through Ferguson, and the Missouri Foundation for Health. Reverend Starsky Wilson is president of the Deaconess Foundation. He first explains the goals.
First is to invest in the capacity of the racial justice movement and infrastructure here in the St. Louis region. We recognize that there have been many people working hard in healing modalities and community organizing, especially over the last 6 years. And that work needs support. It needs rest. It needs a pause, and it needs strengthening. And so the goal of the fund is really to support the folks who are doing that hard work to get us closer to racial equity, and quite frankly, to exercise some of the muscles of collaboration for local philanthropy as we seek to invest in systems change.
Talk to me about what needs to be healed.
Yeah, quite frankly, one of the two things we talk about with the fund is that we need to heal from the community trauma that racial inequity and systemic racism actually causes in us as individuals and as community members, as citizens. But then we also need to heal the conditions that create that. So yes, there's individual, relational, and communal healing, but there's also structural change that needs to happen in order that this kind of harm doesn't come to us again. So in that case, we're really talking about the kinds of public advocacy and policy change that's required in order that we're not in this situation again.
When we think about this, you know, this broader issue of systemic racism that so many still don't understand how it shows up in communities.
Yeah, it's difficult to see how it shows up because we tend to default. On one side, we think about individual interactions. Is someone saying something that's inappropriate? Is someone treating someone differently in a store? That's one thing. That's on one side. On the other end, we tend to, when an appropriate report comes out, we hear about inequities. We see the manifest outcome of African Americans having less opportunities and thus having less accumulated wealth. What we miss is what comes in between, is how we set up structures within organizations and institutions, or how our individual behaviors or biases may show up in the movement of our institutions and systems in order to get to those outcomes without us thinking about them. So I think it's critical for us, for the folks who are doing the work to help us to see that, which is tough work. It is isolating work, to have an opportunity to reflect, to pause, to heal from their own, the traumas of the fact that people push back and tell you that you're not seeing what you see, right? Those folks actually need some space to chill out, to settle in, and to reflect, to be re-energized, to go forward. We need, as a community, to then to spend more time both studying these matters, but not just the outcomes and being able to quote the reports, but actually being able to dig in to learn behaviors, practices, and approaches to shift the policies that create our everyday interactions within our institutions. And the fund is going to try to help us to build toward that.
You said Missouri Foundation for Health, and it made me connect the dots and challenge and want you to challenge people to connect racism with health.
Well, I mean, there are any number of things that show up. The stressors in a work environment, the microaggressions that have to be managed by, let's just take Black women in the workforce. A Black woman with a college degree has health outcomes that are proximate, if not worse, than a white woman with a high school diploma. And that has to do with the additional stress, even though she may have health care, even though she is educated, even though she may have a better job. The reality is that everyday stresses and microaggressions in a community and in a workplace diminish our health. And so that comparison tells us something about what needs to be shifted in the conditions and environments in which we work. And the framing around this as a healing fund and a healing approach seeks to get at those realities. So I think one of the things is that, and as much as we know there are social determinants of health that have to do with what's around us in our neighborhoods, how housing is structured, what opportunities we have, what education we have, We also have to know that the conditions that create that are the ones that have to be addressed.
Clearly, so many people are coming to this, however they have come to it. But we do know that there's some sense of shock and surprise, you know, connecting these dots. How do you, you've been in this work a long time. Is that even anything you stop and pause to think about, that, that so many are coming and saying, wow, it is bad?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, I think of times like this, whether it's this moment that we find ourselves in nationally, because we spent, you know, 8 minutes and 46 seconds watching someone's life force literally choked out of them on video, and that created a national uprising and moment. Whether it's this or whether it's other things that happen in local communities that stoke our attentions, I really see these, whether they're moments of protest or moments of recognition, as opportunities and on-ramps for people who may not have been paying attention to these types of things before to be activated. And then we've got a responsibility, if we want change to happen, to create tables, spaces, and networks for those folks who have been activated to then be organized and mobilized for long-term activity. And that requires the kind of infrastructure that the Racial Healing Fund will seek to support.
How important, and I'm looking at the different things that can be included, partners that are going to come to the table that you hope to fund, and one of those is to, you know, to help, as is written here, to help people express grief and to, and we've talked about healing. Talk to me about the importance of, and the need in the Black community to focus on grief.
Yeah, quite frankly, I think people misinterpret some of the mass gatherings that are happening in the streets across the country as agitation only. They are first and foremost, opportunities for people to come together across cultures to grieve. Some of that is grieving the loss. In this moment, we should note an opportunity to grieve the loss of 100,000 plus people whom we've lost to COVID-19 with its own disproportionate impact on Black communities. Sometimes it's grieving the loss of the idea and the ideal of the American dream. We have a sense of American exceptionalism, about who we aspire to be and who we have understood ourselves to be for so long, that we are a country of laws, of the rule of law. And when we have seen that break down, that is an emotion that has to be processed. When we raise children to say you can be whomever or whatever you want to be, and we see that they get cut down in a moment, when they're on their path and their way to doing what we have called them to do, then we've got to grieve the loss of the aspiration that we have placed in that system and community that we have then lost. And so I think those are all things that we've got to heal from. We've got to grieve. We got to recognize the connection between individual and community trauma. We've got to engage more people in community around systems change work. We got to prepare people to organize for healing justice. And we've got to build local capacity and align resources to make that to happen. It's helpful to note that this isn't a new thing for us, and this didn't happen in the moment. Right? One of the final and most clarion calls of the Ferguson Commission report was to establish a 25-year managed fund to invest in racial justice infrastructure and racial equity infrastructure in our region. Now, the Racial Healing Fund doesn't approximate that ambition, but it is a beginning where more than 10 local funders with some national partners have come together to say, we hear the community. We hear those 3,000 people who said, we've got to invest in this. We know more than 5 years later that it's past due, but we're going to begin again today, and we're going to invest to make sure that our community's future has the resources for racial healing.
And so who should apply? Is this organizations who are doing the work or people who think they want to do the work? I mean, how will that process, who should apply and how will the determinations be made?
Yeah, the first thing people should do right now is they should help us to design the process. One of the things that we learned is that part of the agency and autonomy of the community coming together to design processes for their own healing is healing in and of itself. And so Forward Through Ferguson has begun to launch a process of community engagement where we want residents, we want healing practitioners, we want community organizers, we want child advocates to connect with Forward Through Ferguson through their website and sign up to be a part of the community design process that's going to be happening over the next few months, because the community will decide how these funds are allocated. And then we believe by the fall, we'll be in a position to say, with that community engagement done, with a perspective on what's going to be funded and whether they want to invest in organizations or individuals, then the community will say, why don't you all come? These are the things that we're going to fund. And the community will decide. Those residents who sign up for the design process, the community organizers and healers who are a part of that, they will make all of the funding decisions. So if you're interested in helping to design this process for racial healing in our community, connect with Forward Through Ferguson at their website, forwardthroughferguson.org, and sign up to be a part of the design process. If you're an institution who's interested in investing in racial healing, then we invite you to connect with us at Deaconess. We're holding the funds for the pool. Folks can connect with us at deaconess.org, specifically speaking to our director for partnerships, Keisha Davis, and we will get them engaged with the pool of funders who are working together to make this collaborative work. And we'd be excited to have any community institution that wants to invest in it to do so, and as many community residents as possible to help design it and make the funding decisions.
That's Reverend Starsky Wilson, president of the Deaconess Foundation. He says with a matching grant from Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, $1.4 million has already been committed to the work. You can go to Forward Through Ferguson's website for more information on how to apply for grants and to donate.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of four lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.